الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر
In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, the Creator and Sustainer of the Universe, peace and blessings upon His servant and messenger Muhammad forever. Ameen. I greet you with a greeting that is very common in Islam, greetings of peace. Assalamu alaikum. I'm your host, Muhammad Rashid. Today we have our sixth program in our series dealing with the economic system of Islam. We'll be continuing with the second portion of the topic, production and productivity. I have joining me on the program, as usual, Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
Could I have you very quickly summarize and highlight the main points that we talked about last week in our first program dealing with the topic of production and productivity?
Okay. Our basic approach was that instead of just coming in terms of productivity, in terms of curves and, you know, theory of the firm, instead of getting to this abstract areas, we started from the ideological foundation of production and productivity in Islam, which we felt would be quite interesting and relevant. And we indicated that the basis for productivity in Islam is not merely economic survival, but also seeking the pleasure of God by responding to His directives in the Quran to explore the universe and benefit from it and harness it. We have quoted quite extensively from the Quran, showing that exploitation of various resources is something that is commendable. We are commanded actually to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about varieties of agricultural, water resources, fishery, animal resources. And beyond that, we said that the Quran even goes beyond this to encourage people to explore the various laws in nature created by God, trying to understand the various phenomena, and benefit from it if a person cannot at all use them for his benefits.
Well, I think we have a very interesting program for our viewers this afternoon to get into our topic today. In our previous programs, you clarified Islam's attitude towards progress in general.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd like to ask you how Islam views science in particular.
Okay, well, the first thing to start with is to get some kind of definition of science without getting into complexities. Basically, when people speak of science, they speak of the knowledge of natural phenomena, the rational explanation of existence on the basis of observation, which could be confirmed by experimentation and criticism. Basically, that's what, you know, science refers to. It's
mm-hmm.
not just a speculation. As far as the study of natural phenomena, this was already covered in the previous program. However, let me get to the basic or crucial elements in science. Basically, observation and experimentation. Let's look at the question of observation. When we talk about observation, we're assuming that you have to use the senses, and you have to use reason also
yeah.
in order to understand and connect this observation. As far as the senses are concerned, it is interesting to notice that in the Quran, there is frequent exhortation on the use of senses, which is one foundation of the scientific approach. Many times you read in the Quran, for example, أَفَلَا يَسْمَعُونَ أَفَلَا يَنْظُرُونَ Don't they look or see? Don't
mm-hmm.
they hear? You talk about something really down to earth, seeing, experimenting, watching things. In fact, the Quran even describes people who are turning away from truth as a summul buk. That's among the worst people in the sight of God are those who are deaf and blind. Not physically, of course,
yes.
means people who are avoiding using their natural faculties. In the Quran also, it describes or even threatens that in the hellfire there will be lots of people who have ears with which they don't hears and eyes with which they don't see. Again, not physically, but refusing to use these capabilities. Describing the believers in the Quran also. وَالَّذِينَ إِذَا ذُكِّرُوا بِآيَاتِ رَبِّهِمْ لَمْ يَخِرُّوا عَلَيْهَا سُمًّا وَعَمْيَانًا. That those who, if they are reminded with the signs of their God, the signs again means observing, watching, seeing what is in the universe, when they are reminded with these signs, they do not just fall thereat deaf and blind. So in all of this, and these are only a few examples of many that you could easily find in the Quran, provide for this impetus of using the senses in trying to understand the universe instead of speculation.
Mm-hmm. Well, now we've talked about observation. How about experimentation?
Well, experimentation by its nature presumes that you have some observations. In other words, observation would stimulate you to put what you observe under some test, an experimentation. But beyond that, even we find that in the Quran, there are lots of hints, many of them, but again, for the shortness of time, I'll just give a few examples, which could be easily construed to refer to the use of experimentation to understand things around us. Take, for example, chapter 16 in the Quran, in verse 69. It speaks there about honey. And it says, فِيهِ شِفَاءٌ لِلنَّاسِ, that in honey there are cure, or there is cure for mankind. That's cure of diseases.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is a clear reference that there are certain medicinal value in honey. Well, in order for the audience of the Quran, the one who receives that message from God through the Quran, to make sense of that, then he or she would have to study chemistry in order to find out what are those ingredients mm-hmm. in honey that provides this medicinal value. In another chapter in the Quran, in chapter 57, verse 25, for example, it speaks about God creating the iron. And it says, in iron there is strength and benefits, in plural, for mankind.
Yes.
So here again is an inducement to experiment and study the properties of iron so that you can make the various benefits out of it or derive these various uses and manipulation of that method. And that applies not only to iron, obviously, this is only an example,
yes.
But metallurgical studies pertaining to any other metal would fall under that. So you get, again, physics and you get chemistry. Now, in the Quran, frequently also we get reference to the creation of the human, and that the biggest sign of the existence of God and His compassion, as the Quran puts it, وَفِي أَنفُسِكُمْ, in yourselves, by observing or studying yourself. Again, this is a clear reference to attempts to study biology and anatomy to find out this marvelous thing that God has created. You can refer even to areas giving a hint to the study of anthropology. For example, some verses in the Quran says, أَوَلَمْ يَسِيرُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ, don't they walk on the earth and find out what was the destiny of those, that is, nations before them. Here you get physical anthropology, you get all kind of exploration, trying to find out what happened to previous nations. These are all experimental things. Indeed, to sum it up, in one reference in the Quran in chapter 2, when it talks about the creation of mankind, of Adam,
mm-hmm.
it says that God taught him al-asma'a kullaha. Al-asma' literally means names, but as many interpreters of the Quran explain it, it means that God taught Adam the nature of all things, which was something extra that even angels themselves did not have access to. So knowledge of the nature of things or nature of creation that God has given is a clear stimulus for the study and understanding of the property of those aspects. So from this, it seems to be quite clear that Islam heralds a new spirit, a spirit which replaced the spirit of speculation that was predominant in the past was something which is based on firm knowledge, which is provable, which is subject to experimentation. Indeed, as the Quran puts it in one verse, إِنَّ الظَّنَّ لَا يُغْنِي مِنَ الْحَقِّ شَيْئًا, that conjecture or speculation is no good substitute for truth, or something which is based on firm knowledge. So it's quite fair, I think, to conclude from this that among the greatest contribution of Islam to humanity is this idea of experimental approach.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure that many of our viewers would be surprised when they hear your answer, because I think most people, when they think about the experimental approach, they normally think of it as originating with Roger Bacon.
Right.
How would you respond to anybody who would suggest that Bacon was sort of the father of this whole experimental approach?
Okay, maybe you can put things in their proper historical perspectives. Roger Bacon was born, it's believed, in 1214, so you're talking about the 13th century.
Mm-hmm.
Islam and the revelations of the Quran that we cited already were revealed in the 6th century. Alright? So we're really talking here about 600 years or so before Roger Bacon was born, but all these concepts were already ingrained and inculcated in the minds of many Muslim scientists. And it's not only just a theory, but during these centuries also, there were valuable contributions made by Muslim scientists all over the world to this experimental approach and contribution to science based on experiment and experimentation. That's why you find that some of the fair historians and writers seem to clearly disagree with giving credit of the experimental approach to Roger Bacon. One writer, for example, Robert Griffall, in his book The Making of Humanity, he strongly rejects this notion of giving credit to Bacon for the introduction of the scientific method. And in fact, he says that Bacon was simply one of the apostles of Muslim science to Christian Europe. In fact, in one issue of Encyclopedia Britannica, and I quote this, it says that it is beyond all doubt that Roger Bacon was profoundly versed in Arabian learning. They use the term Arabian here, actually should be Muslim learning, but they sometimes use it interchangeably. That is, should be really versed in Muslim learning, and derived from it many of the germs of his philosophy. This is not an opinion given by Muslims. I think you'll find many Western scholars who come to the same conclusion, but Roger Bacon really was a student of Islamic science and the new experimental methodology introduced by Islam, the Islamic civilization.
Well, I'd like to turn now to some discussion of how this manifested itself in practical terms. I think you've given ample evidence that the Quran strongly supports and encourages progress and scientific exploration, but what a practical effect did these teachings have, and when was that effect felt?
Well, to start with, we can say that the scientific progress, the new revival of science and the introduction of this scientific method, started right from the Quran itself, which generated this new spirit of research, a sort of rebellion against the old approach of rigidity and dogmatism and just imitation rather than trying to find out for oneself. But this kind of progress seemed to have manifested itself quite early also in under the Amawi or Umayyad dynasty. Now, aside from whatever deviations the Umayyad dynasty committed in terms of the system of government, but it is fair also to say that during the dynasty there were lots of poets, lots of scientists, and in the entourage of the caliphs themselves, in their own courts, there were lots of those scientists, which included those who are Muslims as well as those who were Christians and Jews as well. So it was like an open approach of encouragement. In fact, during the regime or the reign of the Umayyad period, we find that lots of physical evidence was left to show the great deal of progress that was achieved. For example, during the caliphate or rule of Abdul Malik, the Mosque of Umar, which is in Jerusalem now, was ordered to be built. And during the reign of his son, Al-Walid, two basic and two very important signs also were left: the Emawi or Umayyad Mosque in Damascus and the Medina Mosque in Medina now, in Arabia. However, we can say that the golden age really of this Islamic scientific progress was during the Abbasid dynasty, which ranged somewhere between the 8th to the 13th century, specifically from 750 to 1258 in the Christian era. And parallel to that almost was also the Umayyad dynasty in Spain, which survived for even longer period of time, from the 8th to the 15th century, from 755 to 1492. For five centuries, as one French writer by the name of Jacques Reisler put it, he said that Islam, with its strength, its learning, and superior civilization, dominated the world for at least five centuries. And that's quite interesting, because many people, for example, think now about the superpowers,
yes,
and their influence or mark on the world. But we're really talking about basically what, the last century or so.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking here about five continuous centuries with the Muslims carrying the banners of civilization throughout the world.
Mm-hmm. I think many of our viewers would be surprised to learn of the Islamic presence in Spain. That perhaps is a topic for another program, but over in addition to the progress that was took place in Spain and so on, were there other centers of learning and research to sustain the progress that you've just been describing?
Okay, well, from day one, like they say, from the very beginning, the mosque, or the place, quote-unquote, the place of worship, as most people would interpret that, has been much more than just a place of worship. The concept of mosques in Islam has been much more than that. So you could say that every mosque was basically also a place of learning, or center of learning,
yes,
on the local level.
Yes.
Many historians also report that when the civilization was flourishing, every city, almost every city, major city, had a public library. So it sounds like a recent concept, but public libraries was something quite common under Islamic civilization. Many historians also report of endowments made for colleges, of bursaries established for students, and in general about the great and respected position given to anyone with some knowledge, with some, especially, you know, scientific knowledge or other useful areas of investigation. However, among the basic and very strong and famous areas or centers of learning, in addition to this local and city type of levels, there was the Bayt al-Hikmah, or in English, the House of Learning or Wisdom, which was established in Baghdad as early, imagine, as the 9th century.
Mm-hmm.
9th century, under the Caliphate of Al-Ma'mun. This was like a complex of so many activities that were going on. It was like an academy, a central library, and a translation center as well. This was one major step in terms of the propagation of learning and scientific approach. The Bayt al-Hikmah, or this House of Learning, was also the genesis, or was responsible for the establishment later of the famous Baghdad school, whose influence, I should say, continued until the 15th century. It was about 600 years nearly of scientific activities. That is basically in the east portion of the Muslim world at this time. In the west, the most important thing, he alluded earlier to Spain also, was Toledo, which was a very, very important translation center, in which many of the works of Muslims in Arabic was translated into Latin in order to be introduced to the Western world at later times, which was in fact responsible for the Renaissance. It is even said that in these centers in Toledo, almost all kind of disciplines were studied: astronomy, mathematics, medical science, chemistry, botany, philosophy. In fact, one of the interesting things I noticed is that they say that one of the popes who reputed to be the first French pope, adopting the name later of Sylvester II,
yes,
he spent 3 years in Toledo learning from Muslim scholars and Muslim scientists.
Now, I think many of our viewers would appreciate some additional information on the connection between Islamic civilization and the European Renaissance. To start with, could you give us some idea of what the situation in Europe was like when the Islamic civilization began to take root?
Well, to start with, suffice to refer to the term usually used by historians and scholars to refer to this period. There are two terms. One, medieval times or Middle Ages, yes, which of course is objectionable because they seem to imply somehow that the history of the world is the history of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So for them that was just a medieval time of decay, then followed by Renaissance, which of course is rather ethnocentric, really,
mm-hmm,
looking at one particular part of the world. The history of the world is not the history of Europe alone. There's no question about it. But the other term also used for it, which is a misnomer also, if you want to generalize it to the rest of the world,
yes,
they call it the Dark Ages.
Yes.
Well, Dark Ages for Europe, yes. But Dark Ages elsewhere, that was not necessarily true. In fact, there was a flourishing civilization side by side with the state of decay that Europe has fallen to at this particular period. Usually, these so-called Dark Ages, I mean, if we apply it to the European continent, extended for quite a bit of time. Usually, they estimate between the 5th and 10th centuries, so almost 500 years. Again, what was the state? It's better to refer even to European and non-Muslim historian, even what they see as the situation of Europe at this time. In Singer's chapters in the book Science and Civilization, for example, he speaks quite in detail about the high stage of or highly savage state in which the people in Europe lived. That's his term, highly savage. He speaks about the lack of personal cleanliness, of the abject poverty and the way people dressed and lived in terms of accommodation at the time where life was much more civilized and much more advanced elsewhere in the Muslim world. An interesting reference also, which is quite an extensive study, called The History of Intellectual Development in Europe. It's composed of two volumes by John Draper. He talks there again about the science and speaks about Spain and how this contrasted quite clearly with what was going on in Europe. For example, he said that in Europe, suppression of science was quite normal. The study of material phenomena was attributed to the will of spirits. He said that if a person, for example, had an accident or just got fever, he ran to the nearest saint shrines, hoping that he will be cured by a miracle. At the time, again, when in the Muslim world, physicians were busy discovering lots of things about medicine and dealing with various ailments. In fact, like Singer, Draper also used the term barbaric to describe the kind of life in which Europe has sunk into. Like I indicated earlier, this is quite a contrast of what was going on, and wonders why the term Dark Ages seems to be overly generalized.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very bad state.
Mm-hmm. Many people claim that modern science in Europe was simply a restoration of Greek heritage. How would you respond to that?
Well, I respond that not from any Muslim perspective, but even referring to non-Muslim Western scholars, that this is not true. It's a statement that's usually made, but it's not correct. For example, in the famous volumes Outline of History by the late H. G. Wells, he said that the Greek did not have really too much knowledge or information about the past of mankind, that their knowledge of geography was restricted to the Mediterranean area as well as the frontiers of Persia, and that the state of knowledge was, as he called, based on rudimentary speculations, and it was very poor in the experimental apparatus, and this is very important, that they were very poor in the matter of experimentation. The same kind of assessment was given by another writer by the name of A.N. Whitehead in the book Science and the Modern World, in which again he agrees with Wells on that point. He said that the Greek were overly theoretical. Science was basically an offshoot of philosophy in their own mind. And the same kind of state applied to the Romans also. But we're not saying, however, and I don't think that anyone is implying that there was no contribution whatsoever of either the Greek or Roman civilization. I think that would be unfair to say. But in terms of scientific development and scientific methodology, it was very, very poor and not based on experimentation, which is a foundation of modern science. So it might have been good for its time, but as far as foundation of modern science, they were quite poor on that score. So I think it's quite erroneous really to claim that the European Renaissance was based by and large on the simply restoration of the Greek heritage. I don't think this is correct. It was based very strongly, as many historians admitted, on the already flourishing Islamic civilization with its new approach and outlook.
Well, you alluded to that, the contribution of Islamic civilization on the European Renaissance a little earlier. Are there specific historical indicators showing this influence?
Oh yes, there are plenty. First of all, it is a historical fact that is quite readily admitted, that for several centuries, for hundreds of years, the language of the Quran, that's the Arabic language, was the international vehicle for scientific development. Just like, for example, today, where most of the advanced work in technology and science is found, for example, in English, French, or German, or similar type of languages. At that time, it was the Arabic language that for any person who wanted really to learn anything about science, you would have to be versed with the Arabic language, which shows again that the works were in Arabic or done by Muslims. Not only this, many historians also say that a person who wanted to learn something about sciences, particularly things like, you know, physics, chemistry, medicine, astronomy, mathematics, could not really do it in Europe because of the atmosphere that you're familiar with in Europe at this time against science. And they report that the only place left to them was to go to the Muslim universities, particularly in Muslim Spain, which was, of course, closer, being part of the European continent. In fact, many of the people who tried to popularize Muslim science in Europe were given a term Mohammedans.
Yes.
Or Muslims.
Yes.
They were accused of being sympathetic to Mohammedans simply because they follow the same or absorb this new approach, scientific approach that Muslim scientists have introduced. In fact, Roger Bacon, the one we were talking about before, himself, was accused himself of being Mohammedan because of following the path of scientific approach. And for that, he spent 14 years in prison as a result of this. So if you really look at it in terms of what actually happened, there is simply ample evidence that students from all over the European continents flocked to Muslim universities, particularly in Spain, to learn through Muslim science and Muslim scientists, brought back this knowledge with them, and that was the spark that later resulted in the European Renaissance.
Well, Brother Jamal, I found this to be a very interesting program. Causes me to wonder why this information has been perhaps not popularized and has really even been suppressed to a great extent. I want to thank you, and I want to thank you, our viewers. Invite you back next week when we'll continue our discussion of the economic system of Islam. Thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.
Allah is one, Allah is one, Allah is one.